obviously, for the markets here.
A rally in financial stocks drove the Dow and S&P 500 to new record highs.
This new rally breaking out to new highs. Some people are insisting this is primarily driven by central bank liquidity. They're calling it Feb.
Clueless Keynesian ritual incantation. The world economy has got dangerous time bombs planted everywhere as a result of zero interest rates.
It will look more like a normal recovery in economic activity. It's not that at all. It's the moving towards an inflationary environment.
Some of the recent inflation data and today is some of the hottest we've seen. So that's creating a dynamic where the Fed's going to run out of excuses.
We're at the halfway point on Fedapalooza here. And the story is that we're not seeing any change. It's take the summer off. We're going to reconsider in the fall.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Another record-setting week on Wall Street as stocks power to levels we have not seen before. It was a week of records and tragedy. Record stock market prices and record low bond yields as Germany and the U.S. issued the lowest interest rate in a bond offering in the history of both countries. And it was also a tragic week. On Thursday, we had the terrorist attacks in Nice, France, with many individuals losing their lives. And as we open up this show, there is a military coup that is taking place in Turkey at this very hour. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. We've got a lot to talk about this week. Joining me in the first hour will be Ralph Ancampora. Remember Ralph, last time I talked to him when stocks weren't doing that well. Ralph had turned bullish, and correctly so, as the stock market is powered to the highest levels that we've seen. He'll be my guest in the first hour. He thinks this bull has plenty of room to run. And Greg Weldon will be joining us as we talk about the breakout that we're seeing in commodities across the board, folks. It just isn't oil and gold anymore. It's base metals, it's cotton and the ags. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets to higher levels this week.
And I'm John Loeffler. And Jim, you know, when you have a coup in German, the word is Putsch, P-U-T-S-C-H, you know, like when Hitler tried to take over the Bavarian government. Do you know why they call it a Putsch?
No.
Well, because you get that many people fighting and there's a lot of putching and shoving.
A lot of putsch.
Now we'll have our German-speaking listeners saying, what? Anyway, history was made this week, and we're not just talking the political arena, but you have to realize this. Bond yields got to levels we've never seen before. I mean, there were multiple auctions in Europe and the U.S., and governments have been issuing bonds at the lowest rates in United States history. In some cases, in the case of the German government, speaking of putching and shoving, they've been putching the levels down further than they've been before. They issued 10-year bunds at negative interest rates. Who's going to buy this thing anyway? So we are going to look at the low interest rates and show you what all of this means right now. And then in part two of the big picture, what is the last option that we seem to be facing here? Former Fed Chair Ben Bernanke was over in Japan this week, sort of indicating to them that they might want to start thinking about helicopter drops of money. Indeed, that's what's going to be the solution apparently around the world for the various central banks. So if they are going to begin dropping more money, what are the implications and what do you do if you are an investor? So all of that's coming up today on the big picture right here on the Financial Sense News Hour. And going first to see what happened on Wall Street this week, Ryan Poplava, it does look like the majority of signals that investors have actually been following have been the buy, buy, buy ones from the central banks and from earnings announcements this week. Seems investors are becoming more and more comfortable with the macro setting. And this is just weeks after the Brexit vote sent shockwaves through the financial markets, but they really came back and stabilized rather fast after that. So what specifically have been the catalyst this week towards breaking the U.S. stock market to an all-time high?
You know, it's funny, you were talking about signals. I thought everyone was focused on Pokemon going around, up and down. But no, it's been political for sure over the past few weeks. But if you recall from June, we had a good backdrop of economic numbers in the U.S., minus the one jobs report I mentioned a couple months ago. Looking at that, looking at May's numbers, looking at June's numbers, things definitely had improved despite that. The jobs report for June, I feel, was the catalyst that started this rally. It was just reported last Friday, the market, the S&P closed at a new high for this year. You know, but another thing I mentioned last week is that we saw, looking at the market from a technical standpoint, market internals were improving. We were seeing a number of advancing issues outpacing declining issues. It was broad participation in the rally that started off that June low. And then really, I think the catalyst was that that jobs number really, we were talking about it here in our office, really incentivized the animal spirits, I guess you could say, of the bulls. Because it's funny, John, the number of bulls back when we looked just a few weeks ago, according to the American Association of Individual Investors, was around 25% bullish. Like I said, just not that long ago. Shorts have had to cover, obviously, with this move to new highs. You know, a lot of shorts may be feeling comfortable jumping in at levels that have historically held the market from heading any higher. So obviously, now that we have, technically, a good trader would stop out of a trade that's not working in their favor. So we definitely see probably some squeezing. And the other thing too is that money managers that have been in cash, you know, some of the indicators that we follow, there's been definitely high levels of cash waiting maybe for some more Brexit fallout over the weeks, ahead of that vote. You know, they haven't felt that. And so coming up with new highs in the market, they're probably feeling some performance anxiety. So, you know, all of these components, they're all really adding to each other. There was also, like you mentioned, some central bank information. And then looking at the percentage of bears, I just took a look. In the last week, ending on the 13th, it's moved up considerably. It's now at around 37%. Historically, I believe it's around 38% is the average. So we're right in there, and not really exceeding the average, but we're not below it anymore by any means.
So as I'm looking at it, the backdrop was there. Too many bearish, too much cash on the sides.
Yep.
With investors probably very nervous about the treasury yield dropping as much as it really has, and using that as a signal to really stay bearish.
Yeah, I've heard that quite a bit. And I mentioned that last week that the bonds looked a little extended. And then technically, in some of the meetings I had with our staff, we were following high yield, was not communicating the same thing. And I'm pretty sure I mentioned it on the show last week. The high yield segment of fixed income area wasn't showing the same type of risk off that the treasuries were. So those two weren't communicating with each other. Obviously, that wasn't going to last much longer. Either the high yield pricing needed to really correct hard, there needed to be some of that defensive rotation there, or a rotation out of those defensive areas in more of the cyclical areas into more stocks, into more high yield. And we definitely saw some of that this week as well.
I mentioned at the start of the show that the media have been hyping up this buy communication coming from the central banks. And you have mentioned, based off of the last FOMC minutes, that they really plan to continue to stay lower for longer based on what they see as being developments in the international scene. So now, you mentioned last week, Ryan, that they spoke about uncertainty more than 30 times in the minutes. It's what I call the global nervousness index, you know. And right as we're starting the show here, we see that there's some kind of a coup going on in Turkey. So this week, what do you think about Bernanke visiting Tokyo? What was the purpose of that? What did he communicate?
Well, there's been a lot of chatter about it. Media reports have been talking about just the possibility that the Prime Minister Abe will propose a $100 billion U.S. fiscal stimulus package. I think in yen, it's somewhere around like 10 trillion. But there's also some guesses that with Bernanke there, he's also talking probably to Kuroda, the Bank of Japan, and possibly talking about there being a possible monetary package here at the end of the month as well. The Bank of Japan is expected to ease at the end of the month based on a lot of media reports, and that will be on the 29th. So, you know, definitely the media and investors are drinking from that Kool-Aid. That happened on Monday. So the answer to problems after throwing money is, of course, to throw helicopters full of money. So, you know, the media picked up on that idea very quickly with Bernanke there earlier this week. And, you know, we've come back to the ground a little bit towards the end of the week, some stating that there was a Reuters article I read on Friday that one of the officials was stating that it's clear they won't do helicopter money. So I got the message, I guess, from the media. But, you know, and that's really to buy perpetual bonds. But they said it is a whole different story to have a combined fiscal and monetary package to expand economic conditions and accommodation. So news is expected on both fronts later this month, and that sent the Japanese market really moving this week alongside, you know, the global markets did well. And when I did my technical review with our team last week, in fact, this was one of the two areas I focused on looking at international developments, looking at the Japanese market near support. And I mentioned that as it looked like a decent value to step in on. But if you consider the strength in the yen as overdone, and I do, you know, just looking at the charts, you know, how many times I keep asking myself, are speculators going to really bid up the currency despite hearing central bankers saying we're going to do more, we're willing to do more? And I really don't know how much more evidence you can see that they're actually serious about that now with Helicopter Ben visiting, you know, just this week.
Okay, so central bankers have waited some time since they made major moves in the first quarter. It really does sound like they're gearing up to do more something. But England said not this week. You know, Jim and I are going to be talking about whether or not banks are around the world spooling up to do helicopter drops, since quantitative easing doesn't seem to have worked. That'll be in the big picture later in the program today. So England said not this week. They didn't lower rates a quarter point, and many people had expected that they would, but they didn't.
Yeah, but they did dangle the carrot of the same thing for next month. In fact, they said most members of the committee expect monetary policy to be loosened in August. So not loosening this week strengthened the pound and euro, led to some weakness in the dollar and strength in commodities on Thursday. But like I said, we're still kind of drinking from the Kool-Aid. There's expectations that they will do something next month.
All right. Well, the earnings season is here, which we always look forward to. So we should probably talk just a bit about it. We've had three quarters with year over year declines in earnings. Estimates are for the second quarter this year to be the same, down 4.9% from last year's second quarter. But this week thus far, investors seem hopeful that the trend could come to an end this quarter or next quarter. So how do you think it looks so far?
About 35 of the S&P 500 companies have reported so far, and just looking at some of my numbers here, yeah, about 60% have beat on sales, and about 77% on earnings, according to this Bloomberg screen. So, you know, that's a fair amount. That's about what we've been averaging, maybe slightly above. The financials had a very good response from their earnings this week, and we had quite a few announcements from them. And mind you, we had the stress test just a few weeks ago. The Fed gave positive approval to many of them to move their plans forward. I think there was only one that didn't. I forget which off the top of my head. But the seven financials reporting this week, all seven beat on sales expectations and six beat on earnings, you know, coupled with a drop in bond prices and a rise in yields. Mind you, a lot of the banks, their performance has really been tied to yields because that's their profit center, higher yields. They can charge more money, obviously, for their deposits, keep those short-term deposits at much lower rates. So that profitability, you know, we're looking at yields going up for them to have that profitability. The yields also communicate something of strength in the market, economics. So when they drop, like I said, the earlier part of the show, a lot of managers were really worried about recession with looking at rates dropping as much as they had. So anyways, you put those all together, the financials had a great week. But right now, analysts have started shifting focus. And this is about the time we start looking at 2017 estimates for earnings. And I've heard talk of $130. So if we combine that, yes, we do have good earnings this season. There's lots of surprises. Hopefully we don't have as wide of a gap of those estimates, you know, down 4.9%. Maybe if they narrow, you could see the market responding, I think, more positively, because that's what the market likes. The market likes inflection points. An inflection of a downtrend in earnings developments would definitely, you know, bring fire to this rally. Fundamentally, obviously, John, not a lot has changed. There is political uncertainty. You named it just now in Turkey, and we're looking at it on our screens from the media today. Stretched valuations, declining earnings growth. The whole Brexit issue is still very unclear, and I continue to get peppered daily with analyst reports on what many believe they can expect to see from the fallout of this. And then also, you know, how is this going to reflect France and their referendum? 2017 is definitely going to be a very political year for them with elections. Anyways, the fact is fundamentally not a whole lot has changed. We have muddled along with economics, steady economic growth, even with low numbers. You know, we had David Rosenberg earlier on this week in his interview saying, you know, we can just muddle through. So seems we're doing just that. And as I have mentioned last week, there's nothing more bullish than higher highs, John. Technically speaking, I'm a technician at heart. So technicals are pulling in cash and bringing it into stocks. You've got government bond issues. Pricing has been falling this week, so there could be some risk off rotation back into risk on into stocks. And like I mentioned, we also saw some defensive areas of the market selling off earlier, I believe on Tuesday, like utilities, consumer staples, real estate, moving more into, again, stocks. So, but you know, we're 8% off the June lows already. Is it extended short term? Yes. You know, watch for how the rally consolidates. That will be the most important cue from a technical standpoint. We got to stay above 2120 to stay in good shape. So that's what I'll be watching.
We'll put it on the, we'll have a little trip meter there that goes off, you know, let you know if it goes off, a little alarm, something like that. So anyway. All right, Ryan Poplava, it's getting to be exciting times. It's really going to be interesting over the next 48 months. So I appreciate it. Have a good weekend.
No problem, John. We'll talk to you later.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Today we are speaking with David Rosenberg. He is a chief economist and strategist at Gluskin Sheff. And David, there's a lot to talk about. We recently had the Brexit. We had the U.S. jobs report. And I would like to start with the most recent, which is the U.S. employment report. And I'd like to get your take on it. I think in your words, you said it didn't really quite pass the sniff test.
Well, I think that the tendency is always to focus on the headline number from the establishment survey, which is the payroll figure. And you got to remember, it's not just a whole report, it's a companion report, because the unemployment rate, of course, comes from the household survey. And so the problem I had was that when you take a look at the household survey, we only saw barely more than 60,000 jobs created in the month of June. That's the survey of households. And then when I go through the report and I see that wages were up less than 0.1%, there was no growth in overtime hours, no growth in the work week. And the fact that such a large percentage of the jobs were in really three sectors, local government and hospitality, leisure, and healthcare, it wasn't nearly as impressive report in terms of breadth and in terms of a lot of the other indicators beneath the surface. So I think the best that it did really was take out the recession scare that came out of the initial number we had for May. That much is true. But it doesn't take away from my view anyway that the labor market along with the U.S. economy is still on fairly soft ground.
Oh, what a week for investors. Stocks have been hitting new records every single day. Is this the beginning of a new bull run, showing that this bull, after 6 and 7 years, still has some legs? Joining us on the program is Ralph Ancampora. Ralph, how significant was this breakout that we saw this week? Because ever since late 2014, the S&P 500 has been sort of in this back and forth trading range. But finally, we got a breakout. Let's talk about the significance of that.
Jim, I think the significance is very high. You mentioned since 2014, it's almost, I'll say, a year and a half of churning. And this, you know, the bears had a very good case of saying there was a lot of supply overhead. Well, that's not the case now. And I don't just see it in the leading averages, the Dow and the S&P, but I see it across the board with individual stocks. And it's very, very impressive. I think we have a lot higher to go.
Yeah, when you take a look at this, Ralph, how many times have you seen in your career what we have experienced this last 18 months where, you know, a lot of the bears, in fact, the last time you and I spoke, you had just had lunch with fellow technician friends, and you were the only bull in the crowd. You had changed from being bearish to bullish, and that was a good call on your part because we've been up and away since then. But in your career, how many times have you seen periods like this where the stock market just churns? And I guess that's what you would call what's happened over the last 18 months. It really went nowhere. It'd go up, it'd hit a certain level, fall down, meet a lot of resistance, but we finally broke through. But how many times have you seen that in the past?
Well, the period that comes quickly to my mind, Jim, is the 1994 period. For 12 months, the Dow and the S&P 500 were locked into, I'd say, a 10% trading range. And under the surface, there was a lot of damage being done. So there was, at the time when I was writing, I call it a stealth bear market. And we basically had that kind of action in 2014, 15, early part of 2016, where the market was in a tight trading range. And under the surface, we had a lot of damage. The Russell was down over 20% in that period of time. And coming out of that low in the late 1994, early 1995 period, we had a very exuberant move to the upside, which led to the next 4 or 5 years of much higher prices. So I have seen it once like this.
Now, when we take a look at what has been working, a lot of defensive and dividend plays have done very well. We've seen utilities hit levels we've never seen before. We've seen consumer staples. We've seen real estate investment trust. How much of this is being driven, Ralph, by the hunt for yield? Because for the first time in my investment career, which spans over 3 decades, and in your investment career, this is the second time we have seen dividend yields higher on stocks than what you can get in the bond market.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, I have to say, with the interest rates around the world at zero or close to it, you have no place to go but in these vehicles that you're talking about, high-yielding dividend stocks and REITs and things like that. So I think it's a natural flow of money to that area. And while we continue to have low rates, I still think those areas will probably do very, very well.
Now, I want to move on away from stocks. I want to come back to stocks, but let's go over to the interest rate side. This week, the U.S. Treasury sold a 30-year bond at the lowest interest rate in recorded history. Germany did the same. In fact, in Germany, you actually paid the German government money to buy a 10-year bond. Instead of you receiving interest, you're paying the government interest. How long or how much lower? You know, we did a show on interest rates a month ago, Ralph, where the British gilts had hit the lowest level in British history since the founding of the Bank of England in 1694. And when you think they can't go any lower, they absolutely do. We touched down to, what was it, 1.35 this week on the 10-year note. So what's your take on interest rates from where they are and where they stand today?
Well, when people seek to buy bonds, bond prices will go up and interest rates will go down. I mean, I honestly don't see that ending, but it doesn't necessarily mean we're going to have a much lower rate. I think we could stay in this area, maybe back up a little bit, but I think we'll be down in this range for a while. I don't see the environment changing.
So is there anything on the horizon now? We've seen the Dow break out. We've seen the S&P. We've seen other broader indexes breaking out. We have some of the high dividend paying stocks like the telecoms have been breaking out to record levels. I've never seen telecom stocks or utilities at these levels before. Is there anything that can stop this once a movement like this begins? In other words, if there was any risk in this market right now, from your perspective, technically, where would it come from?
I think it'd have to be an outside influence. Maybe some reason rates stopped going around, they stopped going down around the world, and maybe central bankers thought to change their policy. I don't see that happening. I think that could definitely be a reason for a reversal here. But right now, I think status quo. I can't pick any one particular item that I think could really, really force a reversal.
So when you have all indexes breaking out, whether you're looking at the Russell, the S&P, and the Dow, are investors better off staying with quality? Because it seems like quality has a high bid to it. I don't care if you're looking at some of the higher quality telecom stocks, if you're looking at some of the higher quality blue chips, your General Electrics, they all seem to have strong bids and they seem to be doing well. Would you stick with quality here?
Well, you know, quality has gotten to us to where we are right now. I think, and I noticed the market's backing off a little bit today. Let's give it a couple of days. The market digests its gains, and assuming that we get a reversal back to the upside, and if that's led by the small and mid-cap stocks and the technology stocks, I think you become less defensive and more aggressive. I think the next leg up, if indeed we have a sizable leg up, it's going to be led by other names. I think you're going to start to see the rotation, which is the lifeline of every bull market, and the rotation back into those more aggressive names. I think that's doable. Oh, by the way, just the last few days, interestingly enough, emerging markets, and I'm totally surprised by all of this, are looking a little bit better.
So when we were going back and forth, as we have in this last year and a half since late 2014, institutional investors have been sticking with quality, which is what we've seen reflected in utilities, your blue chip, your consumer staples. If this gets real legs underneath it and really starts to hit new record levels, that's when you expect to see the rotation. In what areas would you expect to see that? Would it be technology? Would it be industrials? Would it be consumer discretionary? Where do you think that leadership will emerge from?
All the above. Definitely led by technology, small and mid-cap stock. Yeah, I think this could be a very, very broad-based and very, very exciting period ahead of us. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, the institutions being in high dividend and quality stocks the last year and a half, 2 years. And that was justified for them. But in the same vein, and I just noticed today the news came out that mutual fund money flow is starting to come back into the market and hasn't been coming in since April. There's a lot of money on the sidelines. And I think that's going to be part of this transition into technology, financials, industrials, consumer discretionary. It's going to be across the board, yes.
Ralph, do you think one of the catalysts that could send us to very high levels is money coming out of the bond market? Because I know since 2009, a lot of individuals, and I'm talking about individual investors, have put money into bond funds in search of yield and safety. They've been in money market funds, but I'm looking at a screen on my Bloomberg of treasury notes and yields. I mean, you've got 3-month T-bills that are barely, 0.3%. 2-year notes are barely 0.5%. Do you think the next leg, or let's say the jet fuel for the next leg up, could be money coming off the sidelines and money coming off the bond market?
Yeah, well, if you're talking about public money, I think it takes them a little while to really digest what's going on. I think we'd have to be, I wouldn't say a lot higher, but we have to be much higher than where we are now to bring that public money off the sidelines and for them to turn it back on bonds and aggressively into equities. I don't want to say the public is always late, but they have a tendency to wait and see until the trend is really established. It's the institutional, it's the, I won't say smart money, I'll say the informed money is the one that comes in earlier. So I would expect institutional money first, and then later on, maybe a year from now, the public comes in and you'll see that. And by the way, that all leads to this extending for a couple of years this full leg.
So when you take a look at this, I mean, so you mentioned institutions. So if I'm a pension fund like CalPERS and I have to provide benefits for state workers and teachers, I'm looking at the bond market. I'm not getting a return there. It seems like I'm forced to be in the stock market to get those returns to meet my pension obligations. Likewise with insurance companies.
Yes, again, they're not going to turn their back on telephone and things like that. But I'm just saying the other money that is out there, the more aggressive money, it'll come in and it'll come into those new names, those rotational groups. Yes, it's a big force out there. Well, I don't think we've even tapped it. I think we're on the verge of tapping all of that money on the sideline.
Ralph, let's talk about another asset class that has been a star performer this year. In fact, the best performer. And let's talk about gold, gold stocks, and also energy. After hitting a low in February when oil prices got down to $26 a barrel, oil virtually almost doubled in a three-month period of time. You've got big stocks like Exxon and your larger cap stocks breaking out. And gold stocks, in some cases, are up over 100%. So what's your take on gold here?
Well, I think gold, after being in the doghouse for a couple of years, gold is finally bought, okay? And I think the part of the recent strength has been the concern that people had for things around the world, and, you know, we had Brexit and things like that. But having said that, if gold backs down, which it is doing now, I think, on a short-term basis, I think that's a buying opportunity. I don't say you have to buy it today, but I think the longer-term trend is favorable for gold, and you can have rising stock prices and rising gold prices simultaneously, and I think over the next 6 to 12 months that'll probably be the case. So you're getting a little rotation here, you know, you're getting gold backing off a little bit, which it should. Silver has done extremely well, and even crude has backed off a bit. So I think in all three cases, longer term, I think you'll see higher prices.
So given where we've gone, we've seen a nice breakout this week, records being set almost every single day. We're pulling back a little bit on this Friday. What would you be doing? Would you be sitting on the sidelines waiting for a pullback, an entry point, or do you think there are some areas of the market, sectors or stocks that look attractive that are good enough to buy at this level?
Well, I'd be fairly aggressive, Jim. You know, I like the old names. Remember the stock called Texas Instruments?
Sure.
And General Electric, I mean, they pulled back when Brexit and everything else hit. Did a little bit of technical damage, came roaring back after the Brexit blow. And in many cases, they're making multi-year highs. So if you're not in them, I say start to accumulate them. They're looking awfully attractive. Teradyne, I love the old names.
Well, a lot of these companies, they call them blue chips for a reason. I think General Electric is one of the few original Dow stocks that are still around. But, you know, when you can get 3% dividend yields, things like that look pretty attractive when you look at yields elsewhere in the bond market. Ralph, any news on your course? Our listeners may not be aware, but you teach a course at the New York Institute of Finance on technical analysis. You've been working on a online course. Any news you can tell us or share with us?
Thanks for bringing that up. In September, I was supposed to record it a couple of months ago, but unfortunately my wife got ill and I had to postpone it. But it looks like that we're going to actually record it in September. So we'll stay in touch, and shortly thereafter, I think it'll be available.
Well, please stay in touch, Ralph. I want to be one of your first students.
Okay, Jim. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
We had a great lineup of speakers this week on our premium podcast. Hi, I'm Chris Sheridan, host of FS Insider, and we spoke with David Rosenberg this week about the muddle through economy and why he thinks it can continue, but he does see the stock market extended. We also spoke with Bert Doman to get his outlook on the markets, including why he thinks China is still the greatest threat to the global markets. And then lastly, we spoke with one of the world's leading authorities on the high yield distressed debt and credit risk markets, Edward Altman, who many of you may have heard his name if you ever studied for the CFA. He is well known for being the creator of the Z-score, which predicts the probability of bankruptcies. Next week, we're going to be speaking with Ron Stoferly on his latest widely read gold report called In Gold We Trust to get his forecast on the gold market. We're also going to be speaking with a very popular guest, Martin Armstrong, to talk about Brexit, his larger thesis that we are seeing a peak in government confidence around the globe and how that's playing out in the bond market and in the stock market. And we're also going to be talking to Riva Gujan at Stratfor on their third quarter geopolitical forecast. So it's going to be a great lineup of guests and topics that you're not going to want to miss next week on FS Insider.
It's no surprise, just about every day of the week this week, stocks have been hitting all-time records. but there are other asset classes that are going up as well. Joining me on the program is Greg Weldon from Weldon Online. And Greg, if we were to give our listeners some great investment advice about the market, what do you think it would be?
Well, as per our earlier off-air conversation, Jim, I think the best way to give a synopsis right now is that markets go up and down and the world will continue to go round and round.
Okay, if you're listening to the show, hopefully you can profit from that kind of advice. But on a serious note, Greg, let's talk about this crazy market that we've seen since the beginning of the year. One thing that the financial press is really focused on, they're focused on the Dow Jones Industrial Average on the day you and I are doing this interview on a Thursday. It's breaking out to a new record along with the S&P. But let's talk about another sector that's also breaking out, and that is commodities. What's the story with commodities, and what can you tell us about it?
Well, you've got some synergy between the two because the overriding force right now in play is a broadening and intensifying thought process among global officialdom, from central banks to governors. And this is something that really came to a head this morning, and we'll get to that in a minute. But this has been something that's been developing really for weeks prior to Brexit. Brexit has intensified this discussion as it specifically relates to fiscal QE, a new age helicopter money thought process that will take printing of more bonds, buying of more bonds by central banks, funding infrastructure spending, and potentially, in the case of Japan, funding direct intervention on behalf of the consumer to try and boost consumption. And that all comes to a head this morning. And again, this is a conversation I've been having. You know, a couple of my clients are from the academic world, plugged into governments or advisors to governments from the academic side of it, particularly as it pertains to fiscal policy. And there has been a move among the academic brainiacs out there to suggest big fiscal packages. And hey, we can just keep buying bonds because, you know, yields are this low. We'll keep printing bonds. We'll keep printing money to buy those bonds. And we'll use that money to finance infrastructure, fiscal spending programs, debt to GDP ratios be damned, all the rest of it, you know, who cares? Because we've done all this and we still have no real reflation. So how dangerous can it really be? And now you're starting to see the reaction to that is that there is some reflationary impulse, and it takes this level, this degree, this enormity of thought process now. It's, you know, hey, you've got to have a giant bonfire blazing, you know, since really, I mean, we can take this back decades, but let's pinpoint it back to 2007, 2008, 2009, when you had the bonfire representing reflation threatening to go out, and central banks just made it into a gigantic bonfire, threw trees onto this bonfire in terms of monetary stimulus, in terms of the amount of money they printed. The bonfire raged for a while. Well, the Fed's not throwing any more wood on this fire. Other central banks have tried to pick up the slack, but given how big the fire is now, you need exponentially more wood to throw on the fire to keep it at its same level, let alone to make the bonfire bigger. So we've come around full circle now to the point where some serious discussions are being had about some serious intensification of these types of policies. And again, weeks worth of discussion, Brexit happens, and now you got Japan, who's always at the forefront of all of this, and today you got Ben Boom Boom Bernanke in Japan talking helicopter money. And we're doing a special report on that today, really looking at his 2002 speech, looking at Milton Friedman's book, looking at the whole history of this thought process, and it's pretty intense. So to circle all that around to your question, this is why you got synergy in commodities and stocks, because right now it's all process linked to asset reflation, undervalued commodities, emerging markets benefiting. The Fed's not going to tighten. Other central banks going to ease, and you're going to start bringing in even more intense policies on that back end of easing that's going to lift all boats. So commodities are rallying. You see it particularly in industrial metals. And that is linked directly back to this thought process vis-a-vis infrastructure spending that will require steel and copper. And I mean, look at these markets. They're breaking out and breaking out in a long-term technical pattern.
You know, it's amazing, and maybe this is what the markets are really picking up, because we began with QE here in the U.S., then it spread globally. We saw it in Japan, we've seen it in Europe, and then QE lapsed into negative interest rates. I mean, it was absolutely phenomenal this week to see, when you think interest rates can't get lower, it was a historic week for German bond yields and Treasury yields. The Treasury issued a 30-year bond, I think, at a record low interest rate.
And actually, Germany did the same thing with the negative interest rate. You know, other than if you're an institution, Greg, or a corporation that's sitting on, you know, tens of billions of dollars of cash, I just couldn't imagine at the retail level a broker calling up a client, and let's say in Europe, and say, hey, Germany's got a new 10-year offering coming out. If you buy the bond, you'll lose money every year and pay the German government. But that's what's happening.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting from that perspective, because if you go back and you look at what Ben Bernanke's 2002 speech speaks directly to this. I mean, it's really amazing to look at the words that he used. He could be saying that today, but he was saying it 14 years ago in the context of this isn't likely to happen. But if it does, don't count central banks out. To the degree to which gold all of a sudden even becomes a high-yielding asset when 40% of global sovereign debt is a negative yield. This is why you got compression in the U.S. bond market. It's one of the actual yield that's out there. This is why you see the moves that we've seen since Brexit, for example, in sovereign debt, where you got big returns in the 7 to 10 year area for emerging market sovereign debt that is being gobbled up at an unprecedented rate. The hunt for yield has intensified dramatically because of this dynamic on negative yields, to where you see bonds that are not due until 2050. In places like the Dominican Republic or Peru or Romania or, Indonesia and Malaysia, are the prices of these bonds are screaming because they're being accumulated because you're running out of yield for fixed income investors. That also leaves open the possibility that you want to be back in risk assets. I mean, this is what the Fed has been doing all along. And now you see this intensifying globally, which is force investors into riskier and riskier assets. How that plays out, whether the risk is actually no longer there, well, we saw what happened when the Fed tried to pull the punch bowl. I mean, the risk is still there if the Fed safety net is not there, if global central bank safety nets are pulled. Now, again, the case in the U.S. was they were able to de facto tighten policy. They were able to de facto raise interest rates without doing anything because they talked, the forward markets moved. Now they've talked it back the other way. So I kind of look at the Fed as having gone full circle. And what's next for the Fed? Well, if you look at what's going on globally, it's almost like the world is saying the Fed's on board just as much as the BOJ and the ECB and the BOE are. And I think that's a correct assessment from that perspective. You got stocks breaking out. You got industrial metals breaking out. You got gold and silver already having made huge moves. And essentially, the dollar in that entire context has gone nowhere. And that's pretty interesting to me.
You know what is even more interesting when you think about it, Greg? The Fed raised interest rates a quarter of a point last December. But when you think about the Fed raising interest rates a quarter of a point, it almost took them 2.5 years to get there from the time in May of 2014 when they announced the beginning of taper or the idea of taper. By the time they ended taper, and then they took a whole year, 2015, an entire year to raise interest rates a quarter of a point. And I think what really shocked them, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this, they raise interest rates a quarter of a point. They're projecting 4 rate hikes for 2016, saying everything's hunky-dory. And then we began January, and we had 6 weeks of 1 week after another asset classes just plummeting. I don't care if it was oil, if it was gold, if it was stocks. And I think that really surprised them. They got to be thinking, although they still talk about raising interest rates, they really have to be thinking, oh my God, if that happened with just a quarter of a point, what happens if we do that again when we have weak economic news globally?
Well, they can't. And I think that the whole thing is set up by the fact that rate hikes and the anticipation of rate hikes, one of which occurred, but the anticipation, I mean, let's not forget, I mean, it wasn't much more than 18 months ago. The end of next year, Fed funds futures were around 3.5%. So the Fed was talking about the ultimate, quote unquote, normalization of rates. In other words, back to pre-crisis levels, which would mean a 3 to 4% 2-year note. That's problematic. Because what's normal? I mean, you can make a strong case that normal is where we're at now. Normal has been zero because that's where we've been and that's what it's taken to just maintain some equilibrium. And in terms of the Fed, in terms of asset prices, and in terms of lifting interest rates, people ask, why has the stock market gone nowhere in the last year and a half? It's gone nowhere because the Fed's balance sheet's gone nowhere. So, I mean, it kind of still is all back on the Fed. And you see the markets moving here only because the expectation is that things are going to get more intense on the QE side, on the fiscal side, on the spending side, on the printing money side, on the buying bond side. How that plays out in the U.S. remains to be seen, but I think what you just said is a good case in point, that the Fed probably much dissuaded from thinking they can raise rates. The question is, what happens if you start to see some inflation? What happens if all of this talk, I mean, right now, energy is kind of the odd man out because you still are dealing with supply issues and the dollar's not declining. So that has kind of kept the cap on energy prices, whereas, you know, industrial metals are breaking out on thought of higher demand from fiscal spending. If you get a rise in energy prices, if all commodities start to rally, and if thought process is that rallying the stock market is going to ultimately bring some semblance of growth dynamic, and I use that word very loosely in terms of the industrialized macro economies, that could be problematic. I mean, is the Fed going to be expected to raise rates if gas prices go up? And they don't have to go up much from here, given the calendar effect from a year ago's prices. So you got so many cross currents and things to think about. I don't envy the Fed their job. I certainly never do. I don't criticize the Fed. I handicap the Fed. And from that perspective, I think what you said before is quite right. When, and I've said this for decades, when it was monetary heresy to say something like this, when we predicted the Fed would buy trillions of treasury bonds and print trillions of dollars to stave off a debt deflation. I remember being on CNBC in 2006 and saying that and almost got laughed off the stage. Bottom line is, central banks looking into the deflationary abyss will choose to err on the side of ease every time. And the comments from the Fed officials even this week have essentially been, we can fight an inflation more effectively from here than we can a renewed deflationary push. So absolutely, long answer to your short question, yeah, the Fed had to be a little spooked by what happened post-December rate hike to the point where it didn't take much more than 12 weeks before Janet Yellen was floating QE4 for crying out loud. So right now, monetary policy in the U.S. is verbal more than action.
This is interesting because, Greg, at some point, you can only drive rates down negative to such a point. We've got almost a third of sovereign debt now is in the negative category. And certainly, I'm not saying rates can't go lower, but at some point, we are going to have an asset bubble somewhere because all this money that's been created out there is going to go somewhere. It can inflate housing again. It can inflate stocks again. It might inflate commodities. But sooner or later, we're going to get an asset bubble. And I would probably argue, if you take a look at global interest rates, one of the bubbles is in the bond market right now. So at some point, there is going to be a correction, a bear market that will be created because at some point, Greg, don't you think they have to react? In other words, if we start really getting a serious case of inflation, which could come, and I want to get back to what we started with, Bernanke's 2002 helicopter speech, because everywhere I look, you hear it in little nuanced statements coming from Fed officials. You're hearing it overseas. Hey, we've tried QE. We've tried negative interest rates. We still have anemic economic growth. If the economy begins to weaken, what's next? And it's going to be fiscal policy with money printing to pay for it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the trend. That's where it's going to head. I think the writing has been on the wall for a couple of weeks, if not even maybe a month and a half, 2 months, frankly, for me. And we've shifted our focus. But back to the bigger picture thought process there, you do. You have the largest bubble known to mankind in the global bond market. But at the same time, you have the largest ever seen in the history of mankind blower of hot air behind that bubble who has a lot of breath left. And this is Bernanke's comment. I wrote this in the book that I did 2006 where I used the phrase monetary Armageddon, where why can't central banks just turn the key, lift the protector and hit the button that vaporizes every piece of paper in terms of debt ever printed? That is where it's headed. I think there's a shift taking place in terms of how that's implemented and executed, which I think is really interesting because, yeah, it's going to be more spending on infrastructure. I mean, you've tried to do all these things. You've stabilized housing. You've stabilized the banking system. But to the degree that you don't have reflation in wages is significant. So I think that you could ultimately see both sides of the coin. It's not whether it's deflation wins or reflation wins. It's that both become increasingly intense at some point. To the point where, yeah, you can't devalue every currency in the world. And this is the prime argument for a thought process linked to this is the renewal of a secular multi-decade bull market in gold that is destined to take it to new all-time highs.
Yeah, because if you go back, central banks have been struggling against this deflationary wave that we've seen come across the globe. But, you know, going back to Bernanke's speech, and he said, in a fiat money system, central banks can always create inflation if they want to. If the government needs to, what's to stop the next president of the United States, whether it's he or she, saying, you know what, the economy's weakening, we've got a job creation program, we're going to spend an extra $1 trillion of debt, and the Fed just simply comes in and monetizes it. We know if that happens, you can create inflation if the government prints enough money and that money is injected into the economy to buy goods and services.
Right. But the issue then becomes, and we saw this in 2009, we have a very good case in point right in front of us, or right behind us, I should say, where inflation is deflationary. I mean, yeah, with fiat money, you can lift the level of prices. Does that mean you can lift the economy? That's the big question. When you talk about things that are not contemplated in this academic theory, primarily productivity through technology, the loss of jobs through robots, the loss of jobs through technology. I mean, it's been rampant. It's ongoing. It's not going to stop. So from that perspective, that provides the crack in this whole theory, at least, where a lift in the level of prices leads to greater income, which leads to greater wages, which becomes a self-sustaining dynamic. That's the whole Milton Friedman theory. And what's interesting is, I actually, in today's piece that I'm working on right now, I say it shouldn't be called the helicopter money policy. It should be called the flamethrower policy. Because in essence, the bottom line theory behind what Milton Friedman has suggested here is that you destroy cash on hand. The value of cash on hand, the value of savings, the value of the amount of cash that people are willing to hold in any given scenario based on what prices are doing, the idea is to destroy that value and cause people to spend because they're actually sitting on more cash that they don't want to hold, especially, you know, if prices are going up. So it's almost counterintuitive to some degree. And it gets back, if you want to get really big picture, I mean, is there any system that ultimately works? Maybe not. I go back to when I was in my 20s and thinking, well, guess what? Communism's going to fail. And the next step is that capitalism mutates towards socialism and then that whole thing fails. Well, that's kind of what's happening. So from that perspective, we keep looking for solutions in a scenario where I really don't think there are any solutions per se. What there are ways to protect yourself. And that's, again, where it comes in without being a gold bug to where it makes the case for gold, because ultimately they want to devalue all currencies. Well, you know, you have to have a relative dynamic measurement against which to do that. And gold stands out as that throughout history.
In speaking of gold, Greg, as you take a look at the markets, I know you follow Smart Money, the commercials, as well as the other players in the gold futures market. What are those players telling you now? What is Smart Money doing with gold?
Well, Smart Money wants to be long gold, but Smart Money is not buying it right here. So Smart Money is invested already. And if they miss the boat, that's where your demand underneath the market will come from. We already saw that in the second quarter when you dip down just barely below 1200. You got barely to the 38% retracement and boom, that was it. It didn't take much. Speculators are heavily long. Commercials are heavily short. So in this point, it's something of a tug of war and a game of chicken. The overriding factor has been inflow into ETFs. And I think that could be much more sizable than what we've seen already. Although I do think right here, there is some vulnerability in terms of just the technical picture. But on a long-term technical basis, this is really the beginning. The breakout above 1306 was the key that completed a major mathematical pattern. You're talking about 12-year bull market, at least in this manifestation since 1998-99 low, and a four-year corrective mode in gold that was found amazing support buying, wink, wink, a lot from China, beneath the 50% retracement, which you really never closed multiple days below that level. So 4 years, that's a 1-in-3 relationship. You get a 50% retracement. You have an ABC pattern. I mean, the whole thing fits if you take a giant step back to suggest that gold may be overbought in the short term here. But on a long-term basis, it's mutated back to a major buy-the-dip market, technically on a long-term basis, and certainly relative to the background that we're seeing develop right now.
You know what's also interesting, too, is not only gold, but you also have silver breaking out. You also have the gold stocks. So if you look at all the associated assets in categories with gold, they're all supporting each other.
Yeah, and that gets back to your thought process around how much money is floating around out there, too. So, yeah, you've seen the gold stocks outperform bullion. That's been bullish. most recently the breakdown in the gold-silver ratio, meaning silver is now outperforming gold to the upside. You throw in the fact now that you're seeing breakouts in copper, platinum, palladium, aluminum, nickel, steel, iron ore across the board. Does suggest again that although there might be some short-term technical vulnerability in the precious metals, it's game on. And again, a longer-term perspective on that.
All right, Greg. Well, listen, as we close, if our listeners want to follow your work, how can they do so, please?
Well, we'd love to have any of your listeners come get a free trial to our research. They would do that by going to weldononline.com. That's Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N, online, one word. com. Any problems, you can email me directly at Greg Weldon, one word, G-R-E-G-W-E-L-D-O-N, at Weldon Online. And Jim, we've just rejigged and reconstructed our entire research product. You know how I've been doing this 18 years on my own, 31 years in the business. And we think that our new product, Weldon Live, which is a daily 12 to 15 minute video, which is a synopsis that covers everything from global macro, foreign exchange, fixed income, global stock indexes and ETFs, precious and industrial metals, energy, and agricultural commodities. It's a daily video, but the video draws from what we call our chart pack, which is usually 70 pages covering all seven of those sectors on a daily basis. And then our trade lab is the third part of Weldon Live, which is our actual official recommendations from a discretionary view. And we also do some quant work in terms of sectors of various stock markets, Japan, Australia, Canada, and of course the U.S. And all of that now comes combined as one product, Weldon Live, at one very dramatically reduced price compared to what we've sold our stuff for in the past. And we have gotten just immense positive feedback on how simplified it is and how we have maintained the breadth and depth of coverage while honing and sharpening the product, and for sure, in terms of the value relative to the price, we're very excited to be out there and having the kind of feedback we're getting.
All right. Well, listen, Greg, as always, we appreciate you coming on the program. Have yourself a great weekend.
You too, Jim. Thanks so much. You do a great job. I'm always happy to contribute.
Well, we made history this week. Bond yields got to levels we've never seen before. Governments are issuing bonds at some of the lowest rates in U.S. history, and that includes bonds issued in Europe and elsewhere. What is all of this going to mean in terms of investments, and are we headed towards more helicopter drops? It seems to be the pension that the banks are heading to, the major central banks around the world, since nothing else seems to be working to stimulate the economy. All of that, the subject of conversation coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.